I'm Mike Kozer, and welcome to the Lost Ballparks podcast. Ted Simmons was the first catcher in baseball history to start an All-Star game for both leagues. The National League, as a St. Louis Cardinal in 1978 at what was then called San Diego Stadium.
Ted Simmons, I think maybe the most underpublicized exceptional hitter in baseball.
And the American League, as a Milwaukee Brewer in 1983 at Comiskey Park.
Tonight, from the Milwaukee Brewers, catching and batting sixth, Ted Simmons.
Ted Simmons is my guest on this episode of the Lost Ballparks podcast.
This is Harry Carey with Jack Buck and Jerry Gross from the beautiful new Bush Memorial Stadium. And boy, I tell you, this is some sight.
The crowd still is coming in. The bleacher area in center field almost filled. And the indication is that it's going to be a fine Friday night crowd here at the Polo Grounds.
We're underway in the first of a twi-night doubleheader at Tiger Stadium.
Greetings, baseball fans. This is Mel Allen greeting you from Yankee Stadium in New York City.
The F&M Schaefer Brewing Company, very happy to be pouring it to you from Ebbets Field tonight. And there should be a humdinger.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Al Helfer with Art Gleason bringing you Mutual's Game of the Day from sunny Shy Park in the city of Philadelphia.
Just the start of things. Go pull up a comfortable chair. If you want to take your shoes off, go ahead. Wiggle your toes, and we hope you'll have a cold Schaefer or two throughout the evening.
Ted Simmons was an eight-time All-Star, a catcher who could hit for average and power. I mean, take a second and think about all the great catchers that came up from that era. Ted Simmons, Johnny Bench, Thurman Munson, Gary Carter, Carlton Fisk. Between the 1960s and the 1980s, it really was the golden era for catchers. Simmons himself batted above 300 seven different times. He hit home runs in a game from both sides of the plate three different times. Finished his career with 2,472 hits and 248 home runs.
This one's fair, and he will touch them all. Against his former battery mate. How sweet that one must have felt.
And in 2020, was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Ted Simmons, welcome to the Lost Ballparks podcast. I appreciate you taking time for us today. If you're ready, let's jump right into it. Can you talk about when and where you attended your first Major League Baseball game as a kid? How old would you have been at that point? How old were you?
I was 9 years old. My dad told me, son, we're going to the ball game today. Going to see the best hitter you ever saw. Well, I followed the Tigers at that time, and I thought I couldn't wait to get there.
This is Detroit, Michigan, better known to baseball fans as Tiger Town, USA. For here in the motor capital of the world is Briggs Stadium, home of the Detroit Tigers.
Top of the first inning, this batter steps up to the plate, and my father and I were sitting in the upper deck along the first base line between home and first base, and I was looking straight down at this left-handed batter. Had a big number 9 on his back. And that day the Tigers were playing the Boston Red Sox. And my dad turned to me and said, see that big fellow down there with number 9 on his back? I said, yeah, Dad. He said, that's the best hitter in baseball right now. His name is Ted Williams.
Now up comes Ted Williams. He always creates excitement when he digs in at home plate. He's got a rabid young rooter there.
Well, we all know how that turned out for Ted Williams. Hall of Fame, the whole 9 yards. He and Muse were probably the two best hitters that ever lived. I never forgot that. I remember just about everything. But besides seeing Ted Williams hit, the very first baseball game I ever went, my dad ever took me to, I'll never forget the one thing that stuck out the whole time. Sitting there in the upper deck, looking out over that field, back in the old Briggs Stadium, which Tiger Stadium was called back then, they kept the grass out there just immaculate. It was just beautiful. They had freshly cut it. It was a Saturday afternoon, and it had the perfect, you know, mow lines all throughout the outfield and on the infield, and I thought that was the most beautiful thing I guess I'd ever seen.
Such a great memory. Can you describe the day that you worked out at Tiger Stadium as a 16-year-old? I mean, I guess this would have been 1965 or 66.
It was one of the greatest days of my life, because not only did I get to take the batting practice with the Tigers on that day, I also got to throw infield. Bill Freehan was the catcher of the Tigers at that time, and Norm Cash was their first baseman, and all their players were out there, and I'm 16 years old, and we're taking an infield, and I'm throwing to these guys, and they're throwing back, and I'm throwing down to second base just like a normal infield. And when you're that young and you're looking at the people that you were holding their baseball cards, collecting those things when you were 7, 8, 9 years old, now you're right there next to them and on the same field with them. It was pretty special, and I walked around with my feet about 6 feet off the ground for a month or two after that.
You were signed by the St. Louis Cardinals in 1967, and 1 year later, while you're still in the minor leagues, your hometown team, The team you grew up loving and watching every single day, the Detroit Tigers, were playing in the 1968 World Series against the team who was now your employer, the St. Louis Cardinals.
So tune up that Tiger enthusiasm. Hang up those Tiger signs. Let's hear those Tiger cheers. Get out those Tiger hats. Let's never forget that cats eat birds, that Detroit will never say die.
So talk me through that day, the day that you went to watch Game 5 of the World Series. You're sitting with the Cardinals front office folks in the upper deck of Tiger Stadium, watching your favorite team, who happens to be the Detroit Tigers.
Well, I had recently signed in 1967 and had been in the organization with the Cardinals for a year, and I was basically their property. But of course, they knew I was from Detroit, Michigan, and the following year, 1968, they're playing the Tigers in the World Series. Well, I was living in the Detroit area, going to school at the University of Michigan in the off season, so they knew I was in town, and when the Cardinals came to play the Tigers, they called me up, asked me if I'd like to go to the game. In that game, Kaline is up.
A walk to Stanley, loaded the bases, and here's the old pro, Al Kaline.
And there's two men on, and Kaline gets a base hit.
There's a drive into right center, a base hit for Kaline, a run in. There's another one coming in.
And two runs score, and the Tigers take the lead.
That might have been the biggest hit of his life, as he lined the single into right center. The drive in two runs, the Tigers have taken a 4-3 lead.
Well, I got two tickets from the Cardinals, they left them for me, and we were all sitting up in the upper deck along the first baseline, and there were about seven or eight front office personnel, and they were all sitting to my left. You know, I grew up a Tiger fan, and Kaline was my guy, and this game was very close at the time, and it was very tense, and I'm sitting there watching, conflicted to say the very least. Kaline gets this base hit, falls in, two runs score, the Tigers take the lead. And as that happens, I stand up immediately and realize, having done this, I immediately look to my left and I see those seven or eight Cardinal front office people staring not at the ball field, but staring at me, because I'm standing up gleefully, as inconspicuously as I could, rooted for my very favorite player, Al Kaline, who I grew up idolizing. I very quietly, very calmly sat back down and realized that this was probably the very first mistake I'd ever made as part of the Cardinals professional baseball organization. We all got through it. We all lived through it. And I'm not sure I was going to get through it that day, but I did. All worked out in the end.
Tigers went on, by the way, to win that World Series in 1968, beating the St. Louis Cardinals in seven games. Now, listen, Ted, there must have been a point in your career when you're playing for the Milwaukee Brewers that you make a trip for the first time to Tiger Stadium as a major leaguer, an opportunity to hit in the ballpark that you grew up in.
That was also very special because I had come back to the city of Detroit, and everybody that I knew and grew up with around there knew the Brewers were coming back and I was going to be playing in that game. Everybody in half the city of Southfield, Michigan, which was a Detroit suburb, decided they wanted to come to that game. And there was about 1,500 of them or so, and they were sitting up there in the upper deck. Well, Milt Wilcox was a pitcher for the Tigers at that time, and my first at bat as a major league player was off Milt Wilcox, and he threw me a curveball. And the first pitch I swung at, my first major league at bat in Tiger Stadium, official game, he hung that curveball, and of all things, I homered. Yep. And I crossed home plate, and the Brewers' dugout was on the first base side. All that crew from my hometown were sitting up there, along with my mother, actually, and my sister. They were all up there, and they were all jumping down, making noise, acting like fools, and I couldn't believe it. Nor could they, and you talk about picture perfect, and well, it couldn't have been any better. That's what it was like when I came back and hit for the very first time in the park that I attended and grew up in as a kid.
It's so incredible. I mean, it honestly, it's what every kid dreams about doing, right? Coming back to the ballpark that they grew up going to games to as a little kid, and then standing in the box and crushing a home run and listening to the hometown fans now cheer for you. All right, so 1971, at Pittsburgh's Three River Stadium, you caught Bob Gibson's only career no-hitter.
Hello again, everybody, with Jack Buck. This is Jim Woods to welcome you back to Three River Stadium in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, as the Cardinals go for their third in a row here on the banks of the Monongahela.
Can you describe that experience? Walk me through that day.
Now, that was really something incredible, because in that day, the Pirates were known as the lumber company.
Right.
Because they had just one hitter stacked in after another, from Parker to Stargell, or Monster Club. And to no-hit them was just beyond belief. You know, when you catch a guy like Gibson, everything else kind of is downhill from there because nobody has the kind of stuff he had.
You were a young guy, right? I mean, you had just, I think, turned 22 the week before. And Ted, here you are catching Bob Gibson, Hall of Famer Bob Gibson, one of the truly great, intimidating pitchers of all time.
But even for Gibson on that night, he was doing stuff that I'd really never seen. Because in 1971, I just had a little over a year in the major leagues. And he was just extraordinary that night.
The 3-2 pitch struck him out. A letter high fastball picks him up. 6 strikeouts for Gibson.
And by the 4th inning, I realized that something was going on here that was very, very special. His slider was just absolutely unhittable. Velocity on his fastball was a notch or two more than even he would come up with. And by the 4th inning, it started getting quiet everywhere. Certainly on that dugout in between the innings, certainly on that field, I remember it getting quiet. Fans being quiet, Gibson just out there pounding it.
Most of the big crowd sticking around, and you know why with this thing that Gibson's got going. They're going to stick around to see if this, perhaps, is the night that the city of Pittsburgh will see its first no-hitter in baseball history.
Nobody's touching anything, and by the time the 5th and 6th inning rolled around, this no-hitter was starting to take shape, and you could feel it.
Yeah, so there's a hushed silence that comes over a crowd when something like this begins to unfold.
I remember sensing it and saying it in my own mind. I said, you know, this is the kind of night no-hitter is apt to happen. Nobody talked about it. Nobody said a word. Nothing happened. I just remember being quiet. And, I mean, in the stands everywhere. Quiet. And then 7th, 8th. You could see, we're 3 outs away now.
Right. Gibson is only getting better with each pitch.
Strike called on the outside corner. Gibson really powdered one, and he's got some fire left.
This is going to happen. Sure enough, last hitter was Stargell.
He mops his brow. He looks in and gets the sign. He starts the windup. Here's the pitch, and it's a strike called! A no-hitter for Gibson! Simmons roars to the mound!
Game over. No hitter. I'm telling you, you're really not, well, you are part of a game like that as the catcher. But when a pitcher's pitching like this with this kind of stuff, he's really the only focus on that entire field. You feel his presence everywhere. In the opposition's dugout, your own dugout, on the field, in the stands, the people, the fans, everybody senses this on a night like this. That's what I remember about it. I was just lucky to be there, happy to be there. And as you mentioned, pretty special to catch the only one no-hitter that Bob Gibson had.
Bob Gibson did it in just magnificent fashion tonight. If you were here, it would have made you cry.
All right, so Ted, listen, I want to end with this story. And I don't know all of the details, but I do want to ask you about it. I heard you were hitchhiking, and I think you got a ride from a certain rock star across Michigan. Can you talk about this story?
So it was one winter Friday afternoon after classes were over. It was probably 4 or 5 o'clock and it was snowing. And my then girlfriend, now wife, Mary and I are hitchhiking, going ahead into Detroit. And we'd done it before, so it was no big deal for us. And back then, hitchhiking wasn't like it would be today. But anyway, we're hitchhiking and snowflakes are falling and this van drives up, stops on the shoulder just past us, and I say, Marianne, you stop and let's go, and we start running. So we catch up, and it's like this, you know, Ford Econoline van. The guy's driving. He didn't have a sliding door like those vans did, so we both hop in from the front, and Marianne gets in first, and then I kind of climb over, you know, onto the seat, and then she pops up on my lap. And so there was no back seat. The van was just open the whole way. And this guy says, where are you going? I tell him, we're headed to Detroit, headed to 696 and going to book toward Detroit and headed that way. And I said, we're just coming from Ann Arbor, going to school there. He said, cool. So I look over my left shoulder into the back of this van and I see a full drum set. The only thing in the back of that van is this drum set. And I don't think anything about it. Drum set, no big deal. I turn to him, I says, where are you headed? He says, well, I'm going to Detroit. I did a gig last night, at the Canterbury House, which was the music place in Ann Arbor then. If you went to Ann Arbor, you played the Canterbury House. When Dylan came, he played there and all sorts of guys way back then. I said, well, what are you going to do in Detroit? And I see the drum set in the back. You had a band? He said, yeah. I said, well, where are you going tonight? He said, going to Grandy Ballroom. And Detroit area, I mean, the Grandy Ballroom was where everybody went. If you were anybody up and coming or you were established, you were playing the Grandy Ballroom. And so I looked at the guy, I says, hey, what's your name? He said, Bob. I said, I'm Ted. This is Mary Ann. How you doing? And right away, I see the drum set in the back. He says, he's Bob. I said, this got to be Bob Seger. Well, I didn't say anything to him about it, and I didn't, you know, bother him about it or anything, because nobody knew who he was. He was just kind of coming up, and it was like me at the time. I was trying to make it to the majors, and he was trying to make it to the majors. But locally, Bob Seger was known. And when I saw the drum set in the back, and he said had played the Canterbury House and headed to the Grandy Ballroom in Detroit that night, I put two and two and knew it was him. No, he never probably ever remembers this. And all I can say is he probably doesn't know me from Adam. But I heard of him, and we thumbed our way into Detroit one day, and he picked us up and took us 23 toward Flint, north, 696 east to Detroit. Dropped us off on Telegraph and 696, and never forget it.
Wow.
That's it, man. That's my Detroit story. 1968 World Series, jumped up for K-Line, and jumped in for Bob Seger.
It's incredible when you think about it. I mean, think about this. Here you guys are, two young guys. You were, what, 17, 18 years old, and he would have been maybe 21 or 22. And you both eventually end up enshrined. You in the Baseball Hall of Fame and Bob in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Such a great story. Such a great story. Ted Simmons, thank you so much for the time today. It's been a lot of fun. I'm really grateful. Thank you.
All right, man. I appreciate you reaching out to me.
Of course.
I hope you have a great day. You take care.
You too.
Go Cardinals.
So a couple of final notes about Ted Simmons. Ted's older brother, actually both of his brothers, encouraged him to become a switch hitter when he was, 12, 13 years old. And like so many other players who have been guests on this podcast, Ted really learned to hit from his brother whizzing wiffle balls at him from 20, 30 feet away. In addition to being a Hall of Fame baseball player, Ted Simmons was also a pretty incredible high school football player, a halfback, who scored 15 touchdowns his senior year of high school. When he graduated from high school in 1967, he had scholarship offers from Ohio State, from Michigan, Michigan State, Purdue, and Colorado. By the way, Ted Simmons, a brilliant guy. He's got a deep knowledge of so many things, art and history, of course, baseball. He ended up finishing his college degree from the University of Michigan in 1996, some 30 years after taking his first college class, because, as he put it, there are certain things in life that a person is supposed to finish. What a life. What a career. Ted Simmons, my guest today on the Lost Ballparks podcast. The producers of the Lost Ballparks podcast are Ryan Beard, Kyle Schmidt, Mike Lipinski, Xavier Guerra, Briggs Buckingham, Alex Kemp, John Carter, Matty Zavlakis, and Mike Dunn. Thank you again for listening. Have a great rest of your day, and I will talk to you again soon for another episode of the Lost Ballparks podcast.